Welcome. This is Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our articles this time come from The Lumberjack, Northern Arizona University publication, Spring 2026, Volume 3, Issue 2. Our first story is Fighting for a Better Future, How One NAU Student Balances Midterms and Motherhood, by Aria Williams. Tiny dust clouds rise from beneath the wheels of a three-year-old boy's red and silver tricycle as he pedals along a dirt trail. His mom, Alicia Robinson, follows behind and calls out words of encouragement as he speeds ahead during one of their regular walks. The pair explore the Buffalo Park Loop before making one of their multiple weekly commutes to the Navajo Nation, where Robinson's son stays with his dad and other family. Once back in Flagstaff, Robinson uses the time to work, complete assignments for college, and care for herself until she picks him up again. Robinson, 23, is her son's primary caretaker and raises him while studying strategic communication and journalism at NAU. After she graduates, Robinson said she plans to use her education to advocate for and report on topics important to Indigenous communities. She said her Diné and Lakota ancestry motivates her to do this work. Her role as a parent has deepened her dedication to getting her degree, she said, because it will allow her to secure a more stable future for her family. Even just going to college in itself while you're a parent is a huge triumph, Robinson said. As a single parent, I think that my biggest struggle is juggling things with his dad and school and everything. Despite the unpredictability of raising a three-year-old and the frequent changes to their schedule, she said she developed strong self-discipline and a routine. The family starts their morning by making breakfast together. Robinson said her son often accompanies her throughout the day, including to the in-person classes she has 4 days a week. For her son to stay entertained in the classroom, Robinson packs toys, coloring books, and a tablet for him to watch shows. When they are not on campus, the two work as a team to complete necessary tasks. Her son assists with washing dishes and the car, which Robinson said he particularly enjoys because of his love for playing with water. Whenever they are able, Robinson and her son take breaks in nature. In the evening, they wind down by cooking dinner, making art, and playing until it is bedtime for Robinson's son. Robinson said the only time she can focus directly on her schoolwork, besides when her son is with his dad over the weekend in their hometown, is when he falls asleep. With the added constraint of driving over 200 miles round trip to the Navajo Nation multiple times a week, Robinson has limited time to fulfill her responsibilities and must decide what to prioritize. Robinson predominantly takes online classes to ensure she has time for her son. However, her degree requires her to take some classes that only offer in-person sections. Without access to virtual classes and hybrid learning, Robinson said she would be unable to complete her education in part because of the inaccessibility of affordable childcare. Due to high costs, long wait lists, and limited budget, Robinson does not have access to childcare outside of her family. This struggle is not hers alone. Ready Nation, an organization that promotes public policies that support children, reported there is a widespread lack of available, high-quality, and affordable childcare, which it calls a child care crisis. Parents struggling to afford childcare in 2025 lost an annual average of $6,980 per working parent in lost earnings and job search costs, creating a nationwide economic toll. The demand for child care cost assistance in Arizona outpaces the funding available to families. According to the Arizona Department of Economic Security, 11,070 children and 6,560 families for the state's child care assistance program as of February 27th. The cost of childcare ranges from 48% to 72% of the median rent price in Coconino County, according to data from the National Database for Child Care Prices. Without a scholarship, the cost for a 3-year-old to receive childcare at NAU's Early Learning and Development Center is $995 a month. Private childcare centers can be even more expensive. Robinson said her aunt, who has a busy schedule and children of her own, is her only source of childcare in Flagstaff. The weekends when her son is with family are the only times when Robinson can work part-time in retail or complete online grocery deliveries. She says she pays her family's expenses by carefully budgeting the financial aid she receives from scholarships with supplemental support from her child's father. As a parent and dedicated student, Robinson said she needs extra support from her instructors. She said she had a support system with certain professors after opening up about her life and built relationships that lasted beyond her courses. Rachel Cox, an associate teaching professor in the School of Communication, responded to Robinson's needs as a student parent with understanding and accommodation. Cox said she did not just tolerate Robinson's son, she welcomed him. She appreciated that he contributed to the learning environment with a child's curiosity. "It reminds us why we're all there," Cox said. "It connects us to the world and the community." The first time Robinson's son accompanied her to class was during an outside lesson on observational skills. Cox said students practiced factually describing the environment with metaphors and similes while sitting in a circle under the sun. Every fall, Cox teaches a course on environmental journalism and uses the same outdoor lesson. She said her students provided more thoughtful and imaginative reflections compared to the other semesters because Robinson's son participated. "He was in the circle and he was running around," Cox said. "He was looking at everything with those really unique and special child eyes that we all have, but we need to be reminded of it. I think it allowed the students to access that part of themselves, seeing the world in a new way, and it allowed them to create better pieces." Cox resonated with Robinson's background as a mom and student, commuting back and forth from the Navajo Nation. She said she drove the same routes, and a 5-hour round trip can easily turn into a 10-hour struggle if it rains and dirt roads become impassable mud. Cox said Robinson is a brilliant and passionate student, while being a uniquely caring and present mother. During their walk at Buffalo Park, Robinson's son adventures off-trail on his tricycle. After he returns to the path, Robinson carefully removes cactus pieces from the bottom of his shoes and tires. Emulating the precise movements of his mother, he meticulously extracts another small chunk of cactus and tosses it away from the path before he continues to ride. Robinson watches the process and patiently waits, ready to assist if necessary. "Patience, calmness, and understanding," Robinson said, "are the roots of her parenting practice. Her father's level-headed demeanor and desire to understand his children's perspectives inspire her approach. His style of teaching and everything was sitting us down and talking with us and trying to understand where we are coming from, while calmly telling us why we may have done something that wasn't particularly great," Robinson said. "Just him parenting us in that way, it tied into everything that I want to be as a parent." She said her Diné identity influences her parenting in addition to shaping her career aspirations. "Diné stories and lessons teach mindfulness and respect for elders and the earth," Robinson said, and she wants to pass those along down to her son. "There is a very beautiful way of seeing just life around you and everything in general that is taught to you as a young Diné kid," Robinson said. "I would like him to see the value in life all around him, as much as I have been taught to see the value of life all around me." Between classes and the chaos of life, going on walks and spending time in nature are regular practices for her family. Robinson said she loves to spend time outside with her son and watch him use his curiosity to engage with the natural world. Sharing music, watercolor painting, and cooking are just a few of the other activities Robinson and her son love to do together. "Whenever he can be," she said, "he is her enthusiastic helper. He likes to help, and I think that is something that I really enjoy about his little character," Robinson said. Woven into her day, between the time dedicated to her own education, Robinson engages in and guides her son in his learning and growth. She said she believes children are only as smart as the adults in their lives allow them to be, so she encourages her son to experience trial and error. It is an honor and joy, Robinson said, to watch her son develop his own vivacious and kind personality. She said she ends every day happy, knowing she is the one guiding his growth. Our next story is An Epitaph for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives, written by Darby Walker. Note, this story contains mentions of sexual violence, which some readers may find disturbing. Wind howls across the vast painted desert highlands, where a black and white mural depicting three Diné women has stood since February. The colorful landscape extends southeast from the edge of the Grand Canyon and north from the Gray Mountain, with only Highway 89 cutting through it. All three women have a painted handprint covering their mouths, symbolizing decades of violent, systemic silencing. The text beside their faces reads, "Stop Missing and Murdered Indigenous People." Indigenous people going missing or being murdered is so widespread, it now requires its own series of acronyms. Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, MMIW, has been joined by Missing and Murdered Diné Relatives, MMDR, Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, MMIP, and Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, MMIWG. Kayla Yazzie, a Flagstaff resident, registered nurse, and activist in MMIWG, smiles kindly when her young daughter energetically pulls at her long, dark brown hair. Yazzie is familiar with how violence disproportionately impacts Indigenous women. The one that hit a little bit closer for me personally was a girl that I went to elementary school with, Yazzie said. Her name was Amanda Webster, and she is from Cameron, Arizona, which is my hometown community, where I grew up as a little girl. They found her body in a hotel, and I think that's where everything just kind of kicked up for me. 5 minutes after the interview begins, Yazzie calmly asks to take a break to bring her child into the other room. A report by the Urban Indian Health Institute, UIHI, indicates there were 54 cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women in Arizona between 1948 to 2018, the year of Amanda Webster's death. The report specifically notes that cases often go undocumented, stating 5,712 cases of MMIWG were reported in 2016, but only 116 were logged by the Department of Justice. The Murder Accountability Project states 26% of murder cases involving Native people in Arizona remain unsolved since 1976. At least 42 of those cases were left open as of 2017 when the data was gathered. Yazzie participated in prayer runs, protests, and candlelight vigils to raise awareness about MMIWG. She said in her experience, the lack of media attention has been the biggest factor preventing change. We get no type of news coverage on our missing Indigenous women or relatives at all on any type of news source, Yazzie said. And if it is on there, it's probably there for a few months and then it gets dropped. So it's more of awareness and education on realizing that this crisis is preventable. Since early 2025, three high-profile MMIWG cases devastated Native people of Arizona. Emily Pike of Arizona's San Carlos Apache Tribe, 14, was last seen in a Mesa group home on January 27, 2025. Hikers found her a month later, dismembered, more than 100 miles away near the San Carlos Reservation. Chalicia Tia Cole, 16, was reported missing by her family to the White Mountain Apache Police Department in October 2025, and police found her deceased in November. Malika Molly Boone, 8, went missing in January 2026, and police discovered her body a day later in a field in Coal Mine, Arizona. You're listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. To date, in all three cases, no one has been held responsible. It's heartbreaking. It really is to know that Native women are at a higher risk of experiencing violent crimes in their life, 10 times the national average, Yazzie said. Sometimes it's scary to see because anyone can become a victim of it. Anyone. And I just feel like providing your family, your friends, your kids with any type of support and just kind of approaching life as being very sacred, it's very special. According to California Indian Legal Services, more than half of all Native women experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And on some reservations, Indigenous women are murdered at a rate more than 10 times the national average. The UIHI report states issues like insufficient law enforcement resources and a lack of culturally specific victim support systems, among others, hinder the resolution of the cases. Additionally, in cases where perpetrators were identified, approximately half were non-Native, 83% were male, and at least 28% were never found guilty or faced legal consequences. Navajo Nation delegate and Indigenous rights advocate Eugenia Charles Newton has extensive experience with MMIWG. Her advocacy work stems from personal experience. Charles Newton works with the MMDR Task Force to confront violence against Native people through improvements to legislation and justice systems, data reporting, and victim support services. Over the phone, Charles Newton's voice cuts out momentarily. She gathers her thoughts and lets out a deep breath. Her voice starts again, shaking occasionally, but purposeful and determined. In 1995, at the age of 17, Charles Newton was kidnapped, assaulted, and held in a shack on the Navajo Nation for 9 days. She said tribal police officers questioned her story and refused to investigate the person she identified as the abuser because she could not tell them where she was held. "I remember I just felt so dirty," Charles Newton said. "I felt violated all over again. There was no compassion at all." She said the officers continued to ask invasive questions and made inappropriate comments, including asking if she had a boyfriend and saying she looked older than 17. Officers eventually insinuated being sexually active made her story questionable. Charles Newton said the officers questioned whether or not she gave consent because she could not remember the entire 9-day period she was held against her will. "I don't know who in their right mind would think that you would agree to having sex and look the way I looked," Charles Newton said. "My eye was shut, bruises and cuts on my body. I remember feeling so embarrassed, and in all honesty, I felt like it was my fault." In the last 30 years, Congress has passed acts intended to address MMIWG. But according to a report by the Library of Congress, data shows a high rate of violence toward Native Americans from 2010 to 2020. The Tribal Law and Order Act enacted in 2010 by former President Barack Obama requires both the FBI and the U.S. Attorney General's Office to report all investigations and prosecutions on tribal land. The Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act passed in 2013 by Senator Patrick J. Leahy and implemented in 2015. It made it possible for non-Native individuals to be tried in tribal court systems for domestic violence crimes. Most recently, the Missing and Murdered Unit was established as part of the Bureau of Indian Affairs by the then Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, in 2021 to direct interagency cooperation in addressing missing persons cases among American Indians and Alaska Natives. Today, Charles Newton represents women and their family members who are affected by the same violence. As delegate for Shiprock, New Mexico, she must also represent the man who she said raped and kidnapped her more than 30 years ago, as he is still a registered voter living in her district. "I work with a lot of families of MMDR, and I think one woman, the way she described it was exactly what I felt," Charles Newton said. She said, "It's the not knowing that kills me." The MMDR Task Force is establishing a tribal community response plan to provide guidelines for law enforcement in missing persons cases, as well as an MMDR database. The database system is intended to store previously mislabeled and miscategorized data on missing Diné people. The task force holds regular meetings to communicate with the residents of the Navajo Nation and provide resources and education around sex trafficking prevention. More recently, it hosted a human trafficking awareness training session on January 30th, 2026. In our final story, The People Feeding Flagstaff by Katie Soukatos. After as little as 2 to 3 hours without food, a human stomach begins to contract and produce hunger pains. Blood sugar levels drop just a few hours later, and weakness and fatigue begin setting in. Over time, chronic hunger can increase one's risk of anxiety, depression, and chronic disease. According to Feeding America, 1 in 7 Arizonans struggle with hunger, despite Arizona producing 12% of the nation's fruits and vegetables. In Coconino County alone, 14.4% of adult residents did not have enough food to maintain a healthy lifestyle in 2022, exceeding the national and state averages. To combat food insecurity, of local nonprofit organizations make it their mission to cultivate and deliver food to Flagstaff students, employees, and families. Flagstaff Family Food Center, FFFC, is one such nonprofit. FFFC has provided hot meals to Coconino County residents through its on-site food bank and drive-through distribution network for more than 30 years. According to FFFC's 2025 Impact Report, the organization provided 8.2 million pounds of food to northern Arizonans throughout the year. Inside FFFC's office, Sierra Chorovsky takes calls and scans clients' feedback forms. Every sentence she reads will help tailor the organization's dining options to its regular clientele. Chorovsky, vice president of FFFC, has worked in the hunger relief field for nearly a decade and within the nonprofit for over a year. She oversees FFFC's programmatic operations, which includes ensuring the organization complies with government entities and meets each visitor's standards. Chorovsky said she became interested in food insecurity during her time working as a lobbyist at the Arizona State Legislature. While doing contractual work for St. Mary's Food Bank, she discovered how hunger can affect people from every background, not just low-income individuals, and realized she wanted to commit herself to food banking. Food is such a unifier, Chorovsky said. There isn't a single person who can't connect with the feeling of hunger or how food can change your day and what your emotions are. It's a very universal experience. Healthy food is about 4% more expensive in rural communities than urban areas. Chorovsky said many northern Arizona residents pass through Flagstaff to access food distribution centers and government resources that are not immediately available to them. According to FFFC's 2024 Food Equity Report, many Coconino County residents struggle to cook food they receive due to being unhoused or living in areas where electricity and clean water are limited. Knowing this, Chorovsky said she coordinates with FFFC's partners to provide meals that locals can feasibly prepare, regardless of whether they have access to cooking equipment, electricity, or transportation. Everyone needs food every day, no matter who they are, Chorovsky said. Being able to help them get food in a way that isn't making their situation worse or degrading their dignity is something that I'm very passionate about. Chorovsky said she continues coming through FFFC's doors even on her most difficult days by putting herself in her client's shoes. She is constantly asking herself, what would she need if she were walking into FFFC's kitchen looking for food? And she lets this question guide every delivery she arranges. Flagstaff Food Link is another nonprofit organization aiming to strengthen the city's food economy and coordinate educational opportunities for locals to learn to grow their own food. At a Flagstaff Food Link event, Sarah Sprague harvests apples from local orchards, supplying participating volunteers and food pantries with excess fruit that would otherwise go to waste. Sprague is the board president of Flagstaff Food Link and a Double Up Food Bucks specialist at Pinnacle Prevention. For every dollar customers spend through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, at Double Up Food Bucks, farmer markets, or corner stores, they earn an additional dollar to spend on fruits and veggies, dried beans, and edible plants and seeds. Sprague began working in hunger relief through farming and gardening on community land, where she provided fresh fruit to Flagstaff residents who lacked access to healthy, locally grown products. She has stayed in Northern Arizona food equity field for 4 years. It brings so much joy having access to food and having choice, Sprague said. Whether you're a kid and you've never tried a fresh tomato before, or you're getting apples. Gardening helps Sprague root herself in the land around her. She said she began to understand the importance of growing culturally relevant food once she began planting. Sprague said she uses her work to limit food apartheid, a system of institutional segregation causing people of color to face additional barriers to finding healthy food. People have been systemically placed in positions through racism and colonization to not have access to food, Sprague said. Even when they do, it's not the most nourishing food. Because Flagstaff has a high cost of living, it can also be difficult for students and full-time residents to afford food, Zena Lederman said. Flagstaff's cost of living is 19.2% higher than the national average, with a single adult needing a salary of $88,000 to live comfortably in the city. Lederman said her time at FFC has expanded her understanding of the people who come to the organization for food, and she wants to continue creating broad safety nets for Flagstaff residents who need them. It's not just a certain demographic that's coming to us, Lederman said. It's people from all areas. It's families. It's single people. It's seniors. It's children. It's high schoolers and college students. It's people who are working full time but still just can't afford basic things. People are not meant to be isolated, Lederman said, and she believes FFFC's programs allow individuals from different backgrounds to unite in a common goal of supporting the underserved groups who need them most. You've been listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. You can access Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Music is Land Back by Hallucination. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode.